Some scale-up efforts in the past around biomass have put too much risk on the landowner, and I think that needs to be equalized through the system.
It's an interdisciplinary research where to make the overall process sustainable, you need to collaborate with molecular biologists, chemical engineers, environmental scientists, material scientists, so that we can look at the whole chain starting from the raw material acquisition up till end use of the product.
A little over a third of all our greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation.
So we have basically millions of tons of this waste available, which industry has to handle right now as a waste, and we can use it as a source, carbon source, to produce bioplastics or any other high-value bioproduct.
Hello, it's Joni Mahoney, president of SUNY ESF, back for another campus conversation with Professor Deepak Kumar and Professor Tim Volk, and looking forward to our conversation today. So Dr. Tim Volk, I'll start with you. Will you take a minute to introduce yourself?
Great. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here, Joni. So I'm a professor here in sustainable resources management. My focus is in the sustainable energy management program. So that's where I do my teaching. My research is really focused around biomass as a source of renewable energy. So even more narrow, I really deal with woody biomass. A lot of my time is with shrub willow as a fast-growing source of woody biomass that we can then turn into a host of other products. So heat, power, chemicals, biofuels. That's where you have colleagues like Deepak, right? Because I know nothing about turning wood into other products. So you got to work with lots of other people to make these systems work. But I've been here for about 25 years or so.
And you and I crossed paths in a previous life because as part of the Onondaga Lake Cleanup Project, your research was instrumental in some of the waste bed remediation on the Onondaga Lake Cleanup Project. So you were one of the faculty that I knew by name before I came here to ESF.
Yeah, so we met a number of years ago. I think it was a very chilly day up on the waste beds when we, one of the first times I met you. But yep, that's been a great project with Honeywell over the years, right? They're looking for alternative solutions, greener solutions to address the issues out there on the settling basins. And we've been able to develop a system that I think meets their needs, right? But also creates all sorts of other opportunities for growing biomass and making renewable energy here in the community.
And we definitely want to hear more about that. Deepak, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you for giving this opportunity. And I'm an assistant professor in the chemical engineering department. I'm also an adjunct scientist at Institute of Genomic Biology at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. My education is in agricultural and bioprocess engineering, and research here at ESF is around making high-value materials from low-value inputs. But as Tim was saying, we have to be more specific. So what we're doing is we're looking on agro-processing waste streams and converting those into high-value products. Some of the products like Tim mentioned, and others are like bioplastics, natural pigments. So basically what we call biocircular economy concept, and it involves both new technology development as well as computer modeling for sustainability analysis.
You know, one of the things I'm sure people listening to this will see is that having a college community with a mission that's so narrowly focused means that everybody that I talk to overlaps. We're all working toward the same big mission and vision for the college. So let's just start with the basics. What is the bioeconomy?
So, I mean, really the bioeconomy, Joni, is anything starting with biomass-based materials and making different products out of it. So there's a bioeconomy already in place. If you think about the forestry and agriculture industry, for example, that's our current existing bioeconomy. What we really want to do, I think, is use more biomass largely to replace fossil fuels. So where do we bring fossil fuels into our system now and make products out of it? So think about things like fuels, right? Or plastics that Deepak was mentioning, right? Chemicals that are made from oil or other fossil fuels now. And what we want to do is substitute that raw feedstock with biomass, right? And convert it and make products that we need in the rest of the economy. One of the big benefits of this really has to do with circulating carbon, right? So we're all, I think, aware now of the climate change challenge that we're facing and the issues that are, you know, that are ahead of us and that we need to make some dramatic changes quickly. So if we can remove that fossil carbon out of the system and make the products that we still want, right, we can cycle carbon. So that's one of the attributes of it, is that we take CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's what plants do, right? And then we take that biomass. It could be wood. It could be oils from an oil seed crop. It could even be waste streams, organic waste streams that we have, and turn them into valuable products. When we do that turning into valuable products, that's the value added. That's where the job creation is, right? That's where the biggest economic benefits often occur.
What drew you to shrub willow as the biomass that you wanted to specialize in?
I lived and worked in West Africa for 3.5 years. So I did small scale agriculture, forestry development with communities there. When I came back from that experience, my wife's from upstate New York here. I was looking for work, for something to do. I was having a hard time finding a job. Valerie Luzaitis actually introduced me to a guy that was working here, Dan Robeson. And Dan had spent time in Ivory Coast, and I sat down and talked with him, and we connected over West Africa. And then he said, you know, I have a PhD position here, if you're interested in coming and doing graduate studies, and it was around shrub willow. I'll be honest with you, PhD was not in my plan. I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I love what I do. So it's really turned out very well. But it really was that connection with Dan. The thing that drew me to it, Joni, was that it was very applied. So they were working with farmers, trying to help them to understand how to grow this crop. That's what I've been doing in West Africa for 3.5 years, is working in local communities. And so I really wanted to work in an area where the work I did had immediate benefits to people on the landscape, in communities, farmers, landowners. So I kind of got into it, and I've been doing it now for a couple decades.
Isn't that interesting? I've been fascinated by the answer that I get to that question from faculty here at ESF. How did you end up in the specialty that you have? So were you looking at it as a feed source for energy or as a source of remediation for sites like the waste beds or both?
So originally, when Dan was working here, they had just got funding from the Department of Energy for a project called Biomass Power for Rural Development. And it was really focused on finding alternatives to coal to generate electricity. So we worked with what was then NYSEG and Niagara Mohawk, right? They still owned power plants back then. And those two companies were looking for alternatives to reduce the amount of coal they were using. So that project was really built around this idea of coal firing. So you put 10 or 15% wood into a coal system that reduces your coal use, it reduces your emissions and the other pollutants associated with coal. The remediation stuff came later when the energy markets started changing and there was less interest in biomass as an energy source. Then we started looking at other alternatives of things we could do with all this information we'd learned about shrub willow.
So is your work and the work of your colleagues before you what led ESF to have the combined heat and power plant here on campus as a source of our heat off of fossil fuels?
I think part of it was, you know, the work that we do here at ESF related to biomass, wood out of forests, sustainable forest management, all those components of it, right? And ending up using those products here on campus. I think Neil Murphy wanted to walk the talk. So we talk a lot about biomass and managing forests sustainably. He wanted to bring it through to the point of let's use some of those products here on campus for our heat and power, right? Reduce our fossil fuel consumption and bring in woody biomass as an alternative. I think it was a goal to bring that to here on campus, give students an opportunity to actually see it in practice and increase our sustainability and reduce our greenhouse gas footprint.
And it's done all of that and more. Just walking up to the window and seeing the display there is such an educational tool for people who come through to understand what the benefit is of using the biomass as an energy source. Deepak, you use the biomass for a different reason. What are you doing with that same biomass?
Well, I would say the reason is still the same. We want to protect the environment, replace petroleum-based products. But instead of focusing only on biofuel, we are looking at other high-value bioproducts also, specifically bioplastics. And as we all know, plastic pollution is a big concern these days. It's on everyone's mind. And we are trying to identify technologies to using the same feedstock, including shrub willow, as well as other agro-processing waste, to produce these bioplastics, which can replace these petroleum-based plastics. The industry is growing significantly. Currently, it's between, although the exact numbers are different, but $5 to $7 billion global industry, bioplastic industry, and it's increasing at a rate of about 15% every year. So it should double within 5 to 7 years. So there is a market need for that one to develop these technologies. But at the same time, as I'm saying, as Tim was mentioning about bioeconomy, so one significant component of bioeconomy is using waste streams, because in that way, we're getting environmental benefits in two terms. One is we are using renewable carbon source to produce a replacement of petroleum-based products. And second thing is we are avoiding going those waste into landfills. And third is obviously economic benefit to the industries which are producing these waste products.
And if I understand them right, I think one of the biggest issues with plastic, besides the use of fossil fuels, is when they break down and end up in our water and fish are eating.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's the big concern we see, is the pictures showing piles of plastics in the ocean environment. And also, as you mentioned, the conventional plastics also, they basically fragmented and get into aquatic environment, which we call microplastics, which is a big issue for aquatic animals and that environment. So yes, so the bioplastics which we produce, they are completely biodegradable and biocompostable. So that's the focus.
And will we be recycling them, or will they go to a landfill for composting?
That depends on which type of product we are making out of those bioplastics, right? Because there is a lot of applications, starting from packaging material to automotive parts to appliances. So they would have different use and different type of end life. But we have researchers with overlapping research ideas. So I have some colleagues in my department who are working particularly on recycling of these plastics. Of course, these are biodegradable, but it will take time. So idea is, if you can shorten that life, if you have to recycle immediately, so you can hydrolyze these, convert to monomers and use them back to make bioplastics.
So if I'm a young person and I want to get into this field of trying to invent a better plastic, something that performs the way plastic does but isn't the environmental harm, that's a chemical engineering path?
There are a lot of aspects in this research area. So as you mentioned, one is making better plastics. So better could be, again, depending on the application, the properties requirements are different. Second could be making it more economical. Third could be more environmental friendly. We don't need to produce it only on the lab scale. We need to consider the technology which is scalable, right? So that the actual industries can invest in that technology and can scale that up. You can go through chemical engineering route, but it's an interdisciplinary research where, to make the overall process sustainable, you need to collaborate with molecular biologists, chemical engineers, environmental scientists, material scientists, so that we can look at the whole chain, starting from the raw material acquisition up till end use of the product.
We've got to talk about this whole system, right? So the stuff that Deepak does is great, and I could never do it, right? It's well beyond my understanding. So you need people in those fields that are very specialized. But the reality is, if we're going to move the whole system, we need people in every field. We need people that will do economics or life cycle analysis, but we need people that will address policy issues. We need people that will work with the communities and people to help understand how do we get people to adopt and pick up new habits and ways of using materials or selecting different materials. So we need people in almost every field imaginable, because if we're going to move the whole system, not just the little slice that we do research on, you need this breadth of people from all these different disciplines. So people that are interested can tackle this from lots of different perspectives. There's lots of other ways to be a part of the system and making the world a better place.
So it's been my personal experience that people want to be part of the solution. And if they want to be part of the solution in your world, knowing what you've learned, what would you like us to be doing to support the planet based on your research, both of you?
First of it is understanding where we're at some high level. Right? We have a climate challenge, right? This IPCC report that came out just a few weeks ago. We need to start yesterday, like a number of years ago, actually, right? But we've missed that opportunity. We've got to do a lot of things, which means everybody needs to start making some choices. So just having an understanding that that's an issue and a challenge, and then thinking about, where do I fit in, right? Where do I use energy at home, in my transportation system, in the materials that I buy and use? How do I dispose of materials, right? Am I throwing out organic material? Could I be composting it and using it in a different way? Awareness, I think, is the first part. And then finding some little steps that you can take to make a change, right? I mean, maybe you want to change your energy system. Maybe you want to sign up for community solar, right? Which is available all across the region and in many parts of the country. You can sign up and get your electricity from a community solar system, for example, as opposed to just off the grid, which then puts more funds into that system, which allows it to grow and build and become more and more of what's going on.
How likely is it that we're going to put a dent in our energy usage in the United States? Are we moving in that direction?
When you ask that question, I go to this what's called a Sankey diagram that I use in class. It's just a flow of energy. On one side, it's got all the sources, and then it goes through industries. On the other side, it's how much is useful energy out the back end and how much is wasted. When you look at that diagram that's done by the DOE, almost two-thirds of the energy that comes into our economy ends up as waste heat. It doesn't drive a car down the road. It doesn't produce electricity. It doesn't make a product. It's the byproduct. There's going to always be waste heat in energy systems. We're never going to be 100% efficient. But when I look at that, and 60% of the energy we bring into the economy is wasted or lost and not used, we need to make dramatic changes. So the big fields, it's transportation and electricity generation are two most inefficient systems.
You know, I hear that as a tremendous opportunity when you refer to that report that came out about how dire things are, at least knowing that it's under our control to make a difference. When you have such a big amount of waste, then you know that the solution exists and that we can be doing something about it. So Deepak, I'm interested in your answer to that question, but were you going to weigh in on this part of the conversation?
I mean, we all can make difference by making right choices, as well as especially like when we talk about recycling and how we are disposing organic waste, as well as even the plastics. When we say, like, I know we see the recyclable plastic, but do we really throw plastic bottles there? Not everyone, right? So those are the choices which we can make, at least to protect the environment. And second thing is, which from the government side, because a lot of these bio-based industries are driven by, you know, on incentives. Government is already making changes. Obviously, they are providing incentives, but they will have to think more in which direction the economy needs to move and what are the priorities, and accordingly set the incentive to, at least for the initial years, to make this industry grow more.
We've had that some part of that conversation here too, and about how, you know, the policies with incentives really are incentives for people of means. People that are living paycheck to paycheck aren't going to be able to avail themselves of that incentive. And that's really where the density of people is. And so the government really needs to think about how they're going to affect the masses of people that will more likely move that dial. So, you know, it's a coincidence that you're talking about, do we put the plastics in the recycling bin? I happened to see in the New York Times a quiz, and it was interactive, and you could put the items into the trash can or the recycling bin, and it would tell you whether you were right or wrong. And I feel pretty well informed, and I was trying, and I got a lot of them wrong. And that's a problem, because when people don't know, I think it's hard enough to educate people and get them to do the right thing. But when it's so utterly confusing, I think three or four of the items, I think I moved them over to the recycling bin and it said, it's complicated, rather than right or wrong. And then there was more detail. And I thought, wow, I can't imagine how many people are already lost. What are we supposed to be throwing in there generally?
I think the Waste Management Center here, I think the Sustainable Materials Center, that Kate Walker and Mark are leading up, right, are working on this. One of the things is to try and clarify that communication. But we do need to make these messages as easy to understand and for people to implement as possible, right, and trying to remove some of the complication. And I think this other issue that you were talking about, right, how do you reach disadvantaged communities, right? There's this whole initiative in the CLCPA, the Climate Act here, to do that. We just actually had a student defend this morning who was looking at this issue in terms of solar installation and incentives that New York State has done, and it is not equitable. So there's these great solar incentives out there, but if you don't have the capital to make that change, that's a barrier. Even more so, if there aren't people coming to your community, talking to you, maybe in your language, which may not be English, then you're not going to learn about these. Then how do you find out about it and even find out if it's an opportunity? So that you know, Jessica Howe, who did that work, you know, I looked at one of her graphs and I said, you know, we've changed in 2015, but the problem is that the non-EJ communities, the rate of solar is still going faster than it is for the EJ communities. My comment to her is, you need to write a couple paragraphs on what's up with the incentive programs and how we should change it so that it's more equitable and accessible, right? It's an accessibility issue in many ways.
And that's how I've seen it from over here. And I would say with a lot of the federal dollars that have been put forward to stimulate the economy in light of the COVID shutdowns, that's an opportunity. And, you know, maybe we should be giving people a premium for their old gas guzzling cars to get those off the streets rather than the way we're coming at it. It's interesting that your student has learned that, but a faculty member at ESF not being able to pass the what do you put in your blue bin is a problem for the county, not in the planet, and not really for you. So how about the other kinds of biomass? Deepak, you work with some other materials besides the woody biomass?
Yeah, sure. So we are working on a lot of different waste streams, but from New York context, I would say two particular important are acid whey from dairy processing industry and waste fiber rejects from the recycled paper mills. So acid whey, that's a byproduct of Greek yogurt manufacturing and cream cheese manufacturing. So as we all know, Greek yogurt has like skyrocketed last 15 years. So in 15 years ago, the market share, Greek yogurt hold 1% market share of total yogurt, and now it's around 50%. And for every kilogram of Greek yogurt production, we produce around 2 to 3 kilograms of acid whey along with it, which is a burden on industry. And New York is leader in Greek yogurt manufacturing. So we have basically millions of tons of this waste available, which industry has to handle right now as a waste. And we can use it as a source, carbon source, to produce bioplastics or any other high-value bioproduct. So last year, we published research on that, where we demonstrated that we can use all carbon sources available in the acid whey, which are mainly lactose and lactic acid, to produce high yield of bioplastics. The second feedstock, which I mentioned, waste rejects. So that also, we already have funding from New York Department of Environmental Conservation through the SMM Center, which Tim was mentioning. So these are the waste which is coming from these recycled paper mills, because when we do several rounds of recycling, the fiber gets shortened and stiff, which reduces the paper quality, or we can say the paper strength. So they have to reject some of those fibers. So this is a waste which companies have to sometimes pay tipping fee to get rid of it. It goes to landfill. And research at ESF, we have shown that this is a very valuable feedstock because it contains about 40 to 50% cellulose. We can convert those to sugars, which can be used to produce biofuel or bioplastic. So these are two mainstreams, but other than that, we are working on like brewery spent grains from brewing industry, apple pomace, because again, New York is a big apple producer. And recently we started working on hemp processing waste from that is coming from CBD oil industry.
That's fascinating that now people are going to be looking at these waste streams as assets rather than a tipping fee to get rid of it. We might find somebody who would like to buy it because they're manufacturing things based on the research that's being done here.
That's right. So that's why we count these as sometimes negative cost feedstocks. And that's where the big advantage is. But the problem is, one is the low cost carbon supply and the production cost. So you're working on these and using these waste stream, which are, if not negative cost, at least zero cost. So that will significantly cut the production cost of bioplastics or other bioproducts. But at the same time, they will give economic advantage to the industries who are generating these waste streams. And plus, obviously, environmental benefits.
What's the toughest hurdle that you have in your research right now?
The answer could be in various ways. So when hurdle could be depending on if we are looking at the lab scale kind of yields and just solving a small issue right now, that would depend again on the feedstock. For example, in case of acid whey, you have to develop new microbes which can handle acidity and still produce bioplastics. In case of woody biomass or other lignocellulosic biomass, we need to first reduce the biomass recalcitrance by putting some energy in that so that we can release more sugars out of it. But what Tim, I, and our team, we are working on is we are not looking at the small scale. We integrate our work along with the techno-economic analysis and life cycle assessment. So we are looking at from the starting only when we develop process, looking at the commercial aspects. So we develop the process simulation models. So we develop the biorefinery, which is in our mind or which is on paper in actual computer to see that what would be the capital investment required, what would be the production cost, energy use, emissions, and everything. And we feedback that data during process development after identifying which are the bottlenecks in the process so that we're not wasting time.
So you're actually looking at a plate and saying, this is how much this is going to cost over the lifetime of producing it and using it and disposing of it. And that is where the economist Tim come in, is to help talk about those life cycle costs.
So Tim, you can chime in, but let me answer first. So when we say, when I was mentioning process simulations and techno-economic analysis, that's more on the conversion path, like because it's an early scale technology. For example, I said we made bioplastics from acid whey, but is it commercially viable? I mean, how much you're producing from a kilo of acid whey and how much energy, maybe you're putting more energy in producing it than actually you're kind of, you were going to get benefit of replacing petroleum-based plastic.
Right? I gotcha.
So I do that work, then I give that data to our colleagues who work on life cycle assessment and as Tim was mentioning, policy analysis and everything. So we integrate everything using those data as well as experimental data to see what's the overall sustainability of the product.
I think if we think about this whole issue of trying to scale these up, right? I mean, so back when you asked me what interest got me into Willow, right? It was this idea of doing applied work and then helping to scale it to solve a problem on the landscape. And so when we think about scaling Willow and using it for end products, the biggest challenge really at this point is the economics. We've got a system. Is it perfect? No. But actually, if we get a bunch of farmers to grow Willow, they're incredibly creative. They'll improve the system probably faster than we can as researchers, because that's just they want to optimize their system. You know, the challenge is we can grow this woody biomass. We know it's got great benefits in terms of greenhouse gas reduction compared to other fuel. But the economics aren't there, because there aren't, the value of it is not high enough. And part of that's because the products we make out of it right now. So willow that's grown in the state, and there's about 1,200 acres of it, it's all going to a power plant to make electricity. You know, it's 25 or 30% conversion efficiency. You're not getting all the energy out of it. And so the price that's actually getting paid to farmers for those wood chips is relatively low.
Compared to corn or something else they could be growing.
Right. Yeah. So they're not going to keep growing willow if the only outlet's to sell it to a power plant. But if Deepak can figure out how to take some of that wood and turn part of it into bioplastics, and we have a stream that goes off and makes renewable diesel or find some other partners and turn it into sustainable aviation fuel that we need, those are higher value products. Then the value for the landowner goes up, right? And then they're more interested in growing it. So that's the biggest barrier, I think, to advance this system is to how to make the economics work. And it really needs to be done in a way that it's equitable across the system. I think it put too much risk on the landowner, on the farmer, to take most of the risk. Everybody needs to benefit, but everybody should share some of that risk as we grow the system at the same time.
I agree with Tim. And that's what like we can do most of that analysis through this techno-economic analysis, which me and Tristan Brown, another our colleague, we work on that. Because once we have these computer models or this techno-economic analysis framework, so we can do the what we call that sensitivity analysis, like, okay, what will happen if the feedstock price is 15% higher than what we use in the base case, 20% higher. So in that way, we can figure out up to which, like if let's say we make the model from wood chips to bioplastic. So we know what's the selling price of bioplastic is. If we set that, so we can see by varying the price of wood chips, like till what price the process will be still profitable. So in that way, at least we can do some pre-analysis before inputting a lot of resources into that.
So I think the other thing on that, Joni, I think, so if people don't understand techno-economic analysis, and I don't understand, right? So
I'm not sure I can say the word, Tim.
I'm going to give you the high-level thing, and Deepak can correct me. So the thing that I find fascinating, and really this is, again, Tristan Brown, right? He's been a colleague now for a number of years, and I've learned a lot from him, but he can build his model, Deepak can build his model from the bench scale, and you make some assumptions. So we can make bioplastics in the lab. Theoretically, how would we scale that? And you build that into a model. So now you build a model plant, and you run this analysis. And the thing that's great about it is, okay, so here's the overall economics. Okay, it doesn't work. We've got to either lower the cost or raise the price. But then he can look at it and figure, okay, so if we can improve the efficiency of the microbe by 5%, then the economics through the system change. That's the techno part of the economic analysis. So pull a technology lever and see how much it changes your economics. Oh, if we pull that 5% change, the economics look much more attractive. Then Deepak can go back to his bench and figure out, okay, I need to figure out how to get a better microbe in this slice of the process.
Thanks, Tim, clarifying that. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was saying. We integrate this process from the start of process development. So basically, we are guiding our research through this integrated system analysis, DELCA. So we know which are the hotspots where they are either, as Tim is mentioning, energy intensive or will create more emissions, or which are very sensitive. Like, let's say we change a little bit efficiency, but it's going to significantly impact the final product cost, so that we can focus our research on those areas.
You mentioned the Sustainable Materials Management Center that you are working with, and you also said CLCPA, and that has come up in this conversation, but will you remind people what the CLCPA is?
So the CLCPA is the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. So that's legislation that was passed here in summer of 2019, and it sets in law mandates for New York State to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. So I often look at my students in my class and I tell them, are you looking for a job in the energy field? Because we've got a lot of work to do in the next 7.5 years to hit that target. 2050, right, which is most of our students' career, 85% reduction. The CLCPA says 85% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2050, based on what we were doing in 1990. So how do we do that in New York State? In New York State, actually, our biggest source of emissions is transportation. About a little over a third of all our greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation. Buildings is next. We can do a lot to improve the efficiency of a lot of our buildings and save a lot of energy, right, and reduce greenhouse gases by making them more efficient. Then electricity is down low. It's actually only 13 or 14% of our greenhouse gas emissions, but one of the drives to turn our electricity system into a low carbon or zero carbon emission system is because we want to electrify so much. So your vehicle, right? We'd like to run that on 100% clean electricity. But as we build that system out, we need to change our electricity generation system. That's all the focus on building out wind and solar and other systems so that we can electrify more parts of our economy here in New York.
You mentioned Tristan, Bob Malmsheimer, and the rest of the team. You have a role in that CLCPA. When I look at that report, I see ESF as a lead or a participant in multiple areas in that CLCPA. So am I correct in telling people that the most aggressive climate plan among the states is here in New York, and it's ESF that's at the table trying to figure out the solutions to meet those goals?
ESF certainly has a key role. When they pass the CLCPA, there's an overall committee of 20 people appointed by the state, and then they've got these 7 working groups around it that are really dealing with sectors of the economy, and they feed into it. So Tristan works on this one related to industries, right, and the challenges that they are going to have to decarbonize their industries. And so it has lots of direct input there. Bob Malmsheimer works on the Agriculture and Forestry Working Group. So wrestling with the issues on how are we going to lower emissions in agriculture and forestry? And then on the forestry side, how are we going to soak up more carbon with our forests across the state? So they've had lots of input on that. I think on the other side, there's a environmental justice working group, right? I think Lemire Turan and maybe others in environmental science have been putting direct input and had lots of input into that. So there's lots of places where the work that we do, the research we do, the knowledge we have here is feeding into that process. Right, next week, we'll host the public hearings here on campus. And I know there's lots of people that are preparing to do comments or submit written comments if they can't be there in person, right, from here on campus, including a number of students. ESF has got lots of places where we have fingerprints in that process. And I'll give you just one more example. So about a year and a quarter ago, the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, contacted us and said, we've got to put out this report on where we sit on the overall carbon budget in the state. We have no idea how much every year we're storing in wood. So if you think about trees suck carbon dioxide out of the air, they turn it into carbon in the wood. We take a portion of that wood and it goes into flooring or tables or building timbers, right? That's going to be carbon that's stored for a long period of time. DEC had no idea. They could take a guess, but they really wanted to put a better number. And they contacted us and they said, can you guys help us? Oh, and we only have 4 months to come up with an answer because that's when we need to submit it to the state. So, you know, fortunately, we were able to juggle some things and we got a very good grad student and he built a great model. And so that number's in there, right? That's another one of these places. So they took that number and they said, well, this is great. Thanks very much. This gives us much more confidence that the numbers we're putting into the model make sense. You know, Colin Byers is here on campus too. He's building the whole forest carbon model for the state.
I was just thinking about him while you were talking, amount of carbon that's stored in our forests in that CAFRI project that he does in partnership and others with CALS, the College for Agriculture and Life Science at Cornell. I'm also thinking about Paul Crivella and how he has this expertise in mass timber construction and the carbon sequestration opportunities there. And it's interesting just sitting here at the table that when I asked you what's one of the most difficult aspects of your research, it's, you know, the man across the table who can do something to affect your research. When I came, people talked about us being in silos, but we're not at all. We are having these interdisciplinary conversations all the time, and I've been able to witness them right here as part of this campus conversation that we're having.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, as you just mentioned, I collaborate a lot with Mark also. Like, again, when they have to develop sustainable building materials, so they have to look at the economics. So again, I help in the techno-economic analysis part. We have written some grants together. And so there's a lot of overlap because we're all working towards ultimately sustainability, environmental sustainability. And that's a good part also, because these days, most of research need interdisciplinary collaboration. It's like we can complement each other, I mean, in research and strengthen the idea.
And I'm thrilled with our new provost, Dr. Sam Mukasa's focus on these cluster hires. And I know one is in the area where you work with that same idea about that's where these grants are coming from, is to fund this work that crosses disciplines. So I think he's got us on the forefront of that. And those are in the works. So there is one, right? I think, is it Bob Malmsheimer who is the point person for the cluster hire that is in this world?
It's lots of work from people, a wide variety of people that get together and put these things together. So we're looking to hire 5 people, and we really want to focus in on the bioeconomy and pieces and parts here where we have gaps, right, in order to move the whole system forward. So we'll hire, another chemical engineer, right? And so Deepak and his colleagues sort of assess the landscape and what the needs are and where could we add value, a strength we don't have here, right? So we'll have somebody there. We need somebody to look at soil carbon, right? So there's huge amounts of carbon in the soil here, and we need to look at that. And we have one soil scientist on campus, right? He's only got so much time. So we'll bring somebody in to help with that expertise. And I think there's going to be lots of work that has to be done in that field. You mentioned buildings. So we're going to hire somebody in the built carbon in the built environment. So building efficiency, more wood in buildings, more stored carbon, to look at those kind of issues. Where we need a natural resource economist. Both of us talked about economics, right? We need somebody else to sort of, in an overarching way, to help us look at those, particularly to look at job impacts, which is often a criteria that's used in assessing these things at state and federal level. And then finally, we want somebody to look at the landscape. So if we're going to change what we're growing or how we're managing forests on the landscape, to have somebody look at not only is what is that doing to carbon across the landscape, but what's that doing to other things like biodiversity or water quality or soil quality or quality of life in different types of communities. So those are the folks we'd like to bring in. And it is exciting because we look at it and we think, wow, if we could bring this expertise to the table, ESF could really carve a niche out here and be a leader in this field. We already are in many ways, but with this extra support and extra engagement of faculty, it would really put a stamp on ESF. And if we work together, I think we can actually move the dial and make a difference.
when I listen to you, the phrase that comes to mind is we're really firing on all cylinders here. We're trying to come at this from a lot of different angles.
To add on, as you're saying, firing cylinders and different angles, although we till now talked about mostly bioenergy and bioplastics, but we're looking at some other kind of other sector also, and which is kind of bioactive compounds in terms of, let's say, carotenoids, anthocyanins, which are, again, coming from food waste and the food processing waste I'm looking for. So those we can extract and can replace the synthetic dyes used in the food industry. So I'm actively working in that area, which the research I was doing at University of Illinois. So I'm continuing here. There I was working on colored corn, and we were trying to extract anthocyanins as natural color pigment. Here I'm working on, I use the same concept, but integrated, again, more bioplastic component along with it. Like first you extract color, then use the remaining material for bioplastic production, as well as I'm working in collaboration with a colleague in University of Guelph, where we are using carrot rejects, like peel, which come when you peel the carrot and the tip and the front part of that. So we're extracting beta carotene out of it and using the remaining one for biofuel and bioplastic production.
You know, one of the things that's such a benefit is that the generation coming up now wants those things. They will tell you that their dye is natural in the things that they're wearing. And that's going to be a big boost to the research that we're doing, is just the demand that is coming. The generations ahead maybe didn't have the knowledge that the ones coming up now have, and they're going to affect the economy in a way that is going to make this research even more viable.
Right. And another part of this is, like, for example, when I was talking color pigments in terms of carotenoids or anthocyanins, so they are not only going to replace the dye in terms of color, but they are going to give a lot of health benefits also. So that's why we call it bioactive compounds. They have anti-carcinogenic properties. They have a lot more medicinal properties also, which, so they're very, very high value compounds.
It sounds like you have plenty of work for the new faculty that we're going to be bringing on in this bioeconomy cluster. That's terrific. So what's the thing that you want people listening here to take away? One of the things I'm thinking about, Tim, is you and I have had the opportunity to talk about how the willow trees could be planted along the sides of the roads to stop the drifting snow, which not only is a safety concern, but if towns in the city of Syracuse don't have to use the gasoline to run the plows to get that snow back off the road, there's an ancillary benefit. And then you're growing the mass strategically in places where it can provide that extra benefit. And then the mass is available to heat our buildings with the combined heat and power plant. I guess is the message, just keep your minds open to the possibilities with this technology that's coming.
Yeah, so we're actually just getting started. We have a CAFRI, so the Climate and Applied Forest Research Institute that you mentioned, that Colin Bio is heading up. So he's got a website that we're all working on and getting started. We did launch here at ESF this Bioeconomy Development Institute. That's really more focused on connecting, as Deepak was talking, in this scale-up commercialization. How do we take our ideas, connect with industry, and expand that? So that's got a website that's nascent. There is a Willow website, right, at ESF, esf.edu/Willow, if people want to learn about the things that we've done or have been doing with Willow.
I think people would be really interested to see the things that you've done and can do with Willow. And we didn't even touch on the remediation aspect of the willow trees. So yet another benefit of the place where you're planting these masses to use in Deepak's research and in our power plant.
We do things across the landscape. We should not be doing it for a single purpose. And we should really be talking to the people in those communities and thinking about how do we get multiple benefits. So snow fences, we can plant willow in areas where you've got non-point source runoff from agricultural fields, and they can capture and take up those nutrients, use them to grow before they run off into a stream or a lake or the groundwater, right? So ways to address multiple problems at the same time. And then creative back-end uses. So here's a new one we're working on. Instead of putting concrete sound barriers, so when I think about the I-81 project, I think there's like 32 areas where they've identified they've got to put in sound barriers to minimize the sound with communities. So there's a company out of Quebec, right, has designed these willow-based sound barriers with a fiber material in the middle that are just as effective and a much lower carbon footprint. So let's not use concrete with a high carbon footprint. Let's replace it with a more renewable product. You know, just like Deepak, let's stop using fossil-based plastics and plug in biomass-based renewable biodegradable plastics. So I think where people engage in this, right, I think just being aware of it and being supportive, right? When there's an opportunity to buy a biomass-based plastic, and they're out there, they're already out there, right? To be supportive of those ideas. That makes a difference. Also in terms of legislation, right, and what's happening in terms of the political system, people should engage in that. There's this public comment series going on around the CLCPA. And if people have opinions, they should express them. All those things get reviewed. Those comments get looked at. If you don't express your opinion, it's not going to get reviewed. So people should engage in the process.
It's so interesting that we're here because this is where one of our most recent conversations ended. And it was, what's the thing when I ask that people can do? It's learn about the sustainability priorities of the candidates and vote accordingly. And that's a way to support the work that we're doing, especially for us. We can draw a straight line because we get a lot of the dollars to conduct the research from the state agencies, and they are overseen by the people that we're putting into office. So we do have a lot of power when it comes to the ballot box in terms of research dollars for ESF. So this has been such an interesting conversation. I thank you very much for taking time to explain to those of us outside of your world how it all works. And I'll tell you, my biggest takeaway is that there's so many applications. There's so many benefits that can come from doing research in this area. You know, you just very briefly talked on water quality, the remediation, the snow fences, the emissions, the microplastics that we can avoid in our fish and the food we eat. And that work is all being done here at ESF by you and by your colleagues. And I appreciate you taking time to tell us about it. So thank you very much for joining me.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.